In 1929, the Shane family opened our first jewelry store. Even then, we were intent on being different. We wanted to be more than a jeweler. We wanted to be a friend. Our intentions haven't changed. When you visit Shane Company, you're treated like a friend, and your purchases come with the best warranty in the industry. You can be assured we'll always be here for you. Most jewelers will charge you for their warranty. Our warranty is free for a lifetime and even covers the center stone. We're able to offer you an unparalleled warranty because of the quality of our jewelry. Whether it's an engagement ring, a wedding band, a stunning necklace, earrings, or a bracelet, the structure and design of our jewelry ensures it will last a lifetime because that's what a friend would do. Now you have a friend in the jewelry business, Shane Company and ShaneCo.com.
Hey everybody, Bob Saget here, and you know what I am. I'm here for you. Wow, what a clever title for a show when people need people to talk to sometimes. Well, I'm that guy, and sometimes they get to talk to you guys. You can call that phone number up at the top of the menu, and I'll tell you on Twitter and Instagram or Facebook when I'm going to be calling people, and I look forward to hopefully talking to you on this very podcast. I also have wonderful guests, and what do I have to tell you? The business I have to tell you is that you need to rate, review, subscribe, or follow, and give good comments. I can't take the pain anymore. I can't do negative. That's what we got going on. We got too much negative. We have not enough love, and everybody's at each other, and we need to be able to not only come to the table, which has become part of our vernacular, but feed everybody at the table. And I'm very metaphorical right now. I have a friend. I have one. But this man that I'm about to introduce is a friend. And I'm so proud to have known him for a long time. And we actually became fairly close. It's Josh Radnor, the star of How I Met Your Mother. And I got to see him in Disgrace, a Tony Award-winning play. I got to see that. In 2014, and it was nominated for the Tony Award. I always say winning, but if you're nominated, aren't you winning? People say no, because they didn't win. But he is an amazing actor, amazing human being, such a caring, real person. He's also been in the PBS American Civil War drama series Mercy Street, and I hope I get this right. He played Lou Mazzucchelli in the musical series Rise and as Lonnie Flash in Hunters. And I'm saying all that because he might not want to talk about that stuff because he is this beautiful human being that knows that show business is something you do for a living and acting is something that he loves and he's so damn good at it. And I don't know what the conversation's going to be, but it's going to be nice to catch up with him. Because I have so much affection for him. And he's Ted Mosby. And I'll talk about this. Why was I the older Ted Mosby? I don't know. Why couldn't it have been him? I guess I sound gravelly, right? I guess a little bit of alcohol and cigars did what they did. So they wanted to make Ted older. Anyway, it was an interesting thing that I was asked to do it by Pam Fryman, a friend of mine. But we'll get into that briefly, I would assume. And here is my friend, Josh Radnor. Hey.
Hi, Bob.
Josh.
It's great to see you. I'm so sorry I'm 4 minutes late.
There's no time in podcasts. We just cut out the shoe leather.
Yeah. Is my sound okay? You're all tricked out with that fancy mic.
I got the board. I got all kinds of crap. You sound great. And you're framed amazing. That's the director in you. You got the lamps on either side. I got like a half-ass mirror and a light switch, and then that goes up high. But I got, what the hell?
How long have you been doing this?
I started 2 days before, about a week before quarantine. And I did two episodes in studio, and then they brought the board to my house. And I just started talking to people. I call people that aren't in show business and see how they're doing, and they call me. And I talk to one guy, his he lost someone to COVID and he was stoned the whole time. So I just kept talking to him for a half hour. It was like the most fun. That how could you be so, he smoked pot. It made him feel better to laugh at this horrible, horrible thing that we're all living.
He was stoned on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great.
And this is probably the right time for me to admit that. No, I'm kidding. I'm not.
It's fine. I'd be happy. I've had stoned people on here, you know, and I've had a bunch of friends, and I'm thrilled to see you. I'm just,
yeah, it's great to see you. We have a fondness for each other, I'd say. Wouldn't you say?
I did an intro right before you jumped. We like each other.
We do. We always have.
We always have, and we had a syncopado because here you are on this incredibly successful show, and I'm going to share something that's, you know, that I tried to reason with when I did Full House. And I didn't understand it when I was doing it to be the glue of a show. The show's about you. And yet I was going, and I look at it differently now, but I was going, wait a minute, I want to be funnier. Why am I saying these kind of lines? Why am I? And they went, no, you're the Richie Cunningham of the show, and you're the anchor of How I Met Your Mother.
Leading man malaise.
Exactly. And what are we complaining about?
Yeah.
In retrospect, yeah, how do you look at it now?
It's a great question. I mean, we should have a support group, you know, get all the guys together and be like, we're good at being the strong center of a show with madness going on. You know, it's interesting. What's his name? Mike Schur, who created Parks and Rec, and he wrote this incredible piece that every time I see him out, I corner him and want to thank him again for this piece. But when Harold Ramis died, he wrote this piece.
What a huge loss. I did. Yeah. And I loved Harold, one of the sweetest. And I got to talk to his kids and his wife.
Yeah.
It was really interesting and so painful. Some people shouldn't be gone.
This is like, there's no Bill Murray without a Harold Ramis.
Right.
You know? And I look at it as like, I always looked at myself as like the point guard of the team. How I Met, you know, I created a lot of plays, but I wasn't the guy like slam dunking the ball and the crowd goes wild. You know what I mean? Like,
but you were, because you're the protagonist. You were the center,
right? But I always felt like part of my job in that, and maybe you felt the same way, was to be the entry point for the audience. I had to be the most normal and grounded while the madness swirled around me.
Same.
Right.
Same.
And that's a great skill. It doesn't win you a lot of awards, but you can't have a show without it. But it allowed me to find some dynamism and normalcy, if that makes sense. Or like, I learned how to be still. I learned how to be a reactor more than an actor. And I've been doing this. I'm about to do the second season, but I did this show for Amazon called Hunters, where I was not, Logan Lerman was the us, you know, he was the center. And I was one of the wacky constellation characters, and I'll tell you, it was fantastic. You know, it was like half the work, twice the glory. You know, being the leading man is twice the work and half the glory. And you know, that's not to complain. It's like, it kept me humble. It kept me, I think I'm a much better actor after those 9 years, but it was something I was uniquely suited to do. But it was also, it can be hard on the ego.
Very. And yet people don't think of it that way. That's what's so interesting.
Well, if you do it well, it looks like you're not acting and it looks like you're not doing much, but you're actually doing a ton. You're like, it's like the duck, you know, you're calm on the surface. You're paddling like hell underneath to make it all work.
Right. I would have trouble remembering lines because mine was a show aimed at young people.
Yeah.
And yours was a love letter. Yours was a show...
Hours, so we can say hours, Bob.
No, I mean, I just saw on People today. Where are they now? You're the first one listed, and it tells about all your stuff. It tells about the Civil War drama, Mercy Street. It tells about Lou Mazzucchelli in the series Rise, and it talks and Larry Flash and Hunters. The thing I loved, and especially for us, but mainly for you, obviously, when you were in the play in 2014, Disgraced, a Tony
nominated.
That you came
to with your daughters. I remember that night so well. We had such a nice time after.
We did. And it was
25 across the street. Yeah.
And you were so good. And it was such a good play, but you're such a good actor.
Oh, thanks.
Well, it's the truth. So you know.
Yeah, that was a sweet. That was my first. I mean, I did this Richard Greenberg play that summer, and that we ended up doing it at Lincoln Center a couple years later. But that was my first kind of big job after How I Met Your Mother. I went right to Broadway for 8 or 9 months, and it was such a joy. And what a great play! I mean, it was and a great part. You know, it was also fun because my character wasn't the virtuous center. You know, I played the virtuous center for a long time.
You're right. Which, by the way, that's because that's leading man territory. That is what it is.
For sure. But it was also, you know, when you're good for a long time, you're like, I'd like to be bad a little bit, you know, in context, you know.
Well, I played murderers, and that's so rewarding. It's such a good feeling.
It's like the shadow gets to come out and play a little bit, you know. And my character had a couple of moments of mendacity and disgrace that would kind of make the audience gasp. And you realize like, oh, he's charming, but he's a real jerk actually. And he makes great points, you know, he's a very complicated guy. So I loved doing that play, and I'm glad you brought that up. I had no idea I was in People magazine.
I assume
will tell me besides you, but I appreciate that.
It's nice. And it's interesting when I look at stuff about Full House. It's like, why am I listed first? Stamos was number one on the call sheet. You know, it's and there'd be no show without the chemistry of all the people. You had the A-team. You know, your cast was the A-team of people. And so
that was, and it's a little mysterious, like, you know, it's like a romance. Like, why is there chemistry sometimes and why isn't there? You know, it's just like, sometimes they just cast it right. And when they you know, when something's cast wrong, you're watching it and you can almost see the auditions and you can see the network executives arguing over who to cast. And they kind of, you know, it just, you can see the mechanics of it. Whereas if it works, you feel as an audience member, like you're just spying, you know, right, on life, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
you and I met because I used to go do the voiceover and you'd always be there and we started chatting and that's how we became friends.
It's really interesting because I never understood. I was doing a play that Paul Weitz wrote called Privileged in New York at the Second Stage, and Pam Fryman called me, this amazing director, exec producer of How I Met Your Mother, and one of the sweetest people.
Had you met her before? Did you know her?
Very well. Her daughters and my daughter went to elementary school together.
Okay, I think I knew that. Yeah.
So I knew her for years, and her heart is, she's just,
oh, she's one of the all-time greats.
Truly. Yeah. Yeah. And she calls me and says, we have this show, it's a pilot, and we think that you would be good as the older version of this character, Ted Mosby. And I went, well, why can't he do it? Who's Ted Mosby? She said, Josh Radnor, this wonderful actor, and we don't know why. And it was Carter and Craig, probably the sweetest exec producers ever in television.
Yeah.
Writers. And she said, I just think we all think that you might be a good version of Josh when he's older. I went, well, honestly, why can't he do it? It should be him, right?
I appreciate you fighting for me. I would have liked the pay bump too.
But didn't that enter your mind? It's like, oh, why 100%.
And it was funny because they said, we don't think your voice sounds old enough, but I don't know that my voice right now, when I'd be the appropriate age to do it, is all that different than it was when we started, you know.
In 20 years, you're going to have this voice, and then they'll know they made a mistake.
Yeah, and when they reboot it, maybe I'll have your gig.
Well, maybe I'll have you be me as a young man.
Yeah.
When I'm, you know, 20 years from now, when I'm with assistance.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to know you and have this weird forever bond with you. So that works out. But I agree with you. I always wanted to do the narration. I always thought it would make more sense if I was doing it. But
it was hard to wrap my hands around that. And then I realized, okay, so this is my rationalization. He smoked a lot and drank a lot. So your voice does change. My voice is lower than it was, but that's what happens with age. So you will, when you hit 64, how old are you now?
I just turned 46.
Well, you're a baby. You know, as Norman Lear says to me, you're a baby. And I went, thank you, 98 genius.
Bob, did you, last time we had dinner, you were right about to get married or you were just engaged?
I am married. And you couldn't come to the wedding, if I recall.
I believe I couldn't because I didn't.
You're not in the pictures. Weren't there.
I wasn't there. Where did you get married and when?
We got married 3 years ago at Shutters. But before that, we got secretly married in Norwalk at the courthouse because I had heard of people getting married. Jonathan Silverman married us.
He's my neighbor. I just ran into him walking through my neighbor.
He is an angel. He's
nice.
The nicest. And he's of the same ilk as we are.
He had to be that centered leading man of
dark featured
guy. That's sometimes what being of a leading man feels like. It's like holding up the dead guy.
Comedy timing, able to not talk and be on screen the whole time.
All of it. Yeah, he's good at it.
He's wonderful. But he married us, but I went, sometimes these documents don't get through to City Hall. So we got married before the actual wedding, just with the Justice of the Peace. And it felt kind of cool because we had our own private little thing, but I'm incredibly happy.
That's good. Mazel tov.
Thanks.
And I feel like the last time I saw you, we had that incredible steak dinner and got the tour of the freezers. Do you remember that?
At APL. That's Adam Perry Lang and Jimmy Kimmel's an owner and a bunch of people are. And we went down to the cellar, and it's a couple thousand feet of the best meat. For those people that don't like that people eat meat, if you're going to, this is the way to go.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's, you know, 1 year old meat. And I'm going, that's going to be rotten. No, it's not. Yeah.
That was a real feast that night.
Yeah, I had trouble. I think I eliminated it a month ago.
We won't count this.
But the thing that I remember that I loved a lot, one time we went to dinner. We were on Melrose or something, and we were both single. And we tried this restaurant. I think you suggested it, which is sadly no longer open, which a lot are not at great grammar. Anyway, and we were there and some young lady came over to you. And then she looked at me and then she was like really taken by both of us. And I think I made a joke, not in a lascivious way, but I said, what age Ted Mosby are you interested in?
The answer?
The answer is you. I mean, no question. No question. And you were in Ted Mosby time too. You had the perfect hair cropped, you know, you had to be exactly as
unlike my woolly current self. So
I was pretty woolly, but I've been shooting a couple of TV things in it's weird, you know, with the controlled stuff.
Oh, you're working right now?
I shot something yesterday, and I shot something, a show that I decided to do because Ken Jeong's a friend of mine and it's done by the people that do Masked Singer. It's called I Can See Your Voice. Joel McHale did it and Cheryl Hines, and I thought this would be fun, and it really was fun. But it's, you know, you're 10 feet from everybody.
Yeah.
There's no audience, and it's 150 people get to go back to work, but it's very strange, and it's wonderful they're working. It feels good to be doing something, but and I don't know if I would have done the same. I don't know if I would have done it if it wasn't COVID time, you know, but
this is altering the course of everything. I mean, who knows? Like, all of our lives are going to be different because this is such a mass disruption
forever for all of us.
Even these little, you know, these little things that look kind of inconsequential end up being big redirections, you know? So people are going to get married because of this. Children are going to be born because of this. Because of this, and people are going to get divorced because of it. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot. How have you been holding up?
I'm pretty good. You know, the thing I care most about is my kids, my wife. But I like quarantine with her because she can't leave because right. She travels a lot for work. She does a lot of you know, touring for her travel production company. And she's been doing some COVID safe traveling things that companies are having her do. And there are ways to actually go on a vacation safely, but I like it at home. It's like Beauty and the Beast here. She just can't leave. I've got a flower with a dome over it, you know, waiting for the leaf to come off.
Yeah.
But I'm just saddened, as I know you are, at the state of the world and why people are where they're at. And
yeah,
all the dissension, injustices, and all the lies. And I know where you lay on it, and same as I do.
Anti-lie and deception.
It's like a bad magician. It's just, but it's working. People sometimes love a bad, if you're on a cruise and you want to be on a cruise and you got a bad magician, you think they're great.
They're a lifesaver. Yeah. Yeah. It's I had a really bad week last week. Not it wasn't bad in the aggregate. It was more like, you know, when you can't turn the catastrophizing voice off in your head, the anxiety kind of like looking out over the horizon is like, this does not look good. You know, the fires were raging. They're still raging. It's like,
I had it last week also. I think a lot of us did.
Yeah. And I was exhausted, like physically exhausted. And Sarah Silverman said something about that on Twitter. Like, it was affecting my energy levels in such a deep way. It was like this psychic depression meets like fatigue, and I just couldn't make my way out of it. And then I've been really kind of unhealthily obsessed with this QAnon nonsense. That's, you know, just like these people falling for just these loopiest of
how can a person's IQ be so low? I mean, everyone's allowed to believe what they want, but don't tell me the world is flat. And yeah, don't tell me that people in politics you don't like have pizza parlors and in the basement they eat babies.
Right.
That's my joke was, which you can't really joke about it, but that they got it wrong. They're so illiterate. What it was baby gates, not pizza gate. And they were putting up baby gates so the babies would be safe. And then they had a pizza party.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah,
what Hillary did. She was just trying to protect the children. But yeah, To accuse people of being cannibals? I mean,
well, the problem is when you make your enemies into baby killing, blood draining, Satan worshiping viewers, you then have like a really tidy explanation for why everything's the way it is.
Oh, it can let you be completely out of your mind.
And the scary thing is it allows you to, I mean, once the dehumanization happens, anything can happen. And a couple of Jewish guys understand that. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So I'm trying to stay out of that space and stay on the side of hope and, you know, combat this stuff where I see it. QAnon's made all these inroads into health and wellness communities. It's really alarming. There's a great podcast that I've been super into that Ben Lee turned me on to called Conspirituality, about where the conspiracy mongering and the spiritual communities are kind of meeting.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, when we don't have a shared agreed upon notion of reality, that's where things get really scary. And we don't have one right now.
No, everyone. And did you see the thing on Netflix, the documentary? Yeah. The Social yeah. Dilemma.
Yeah, I did.
It just, it feeds whatever the fuck you want to believe.
It amplifies interest. So,
and it's your algorithms. So my wife has one. I have one. It's different. You bring up different stuff.
So I don't know the best way to combat this other than me personally just keeping my wits about me, staying centered, you know, being an available, being a good citizen. You know what I mean? Like really not retweeting and reposting without fact checking. That's like a basic civic duty right now. Like where is this? What is this site?
Everybody says to you, I heard.
Yeah.
Everybody. Did you see the latest?
Yeah.
And it's like, where did you get it? I need to know where. And they'll say Wall Street Journal. And I'll say, was it an op-ed? And I would trust Wall Street Journal. I would trust New York Times. But then I go, is this an opinion or is this actual? I mean, Bob Woodward, I mean, I don't want to get into it because it's just so exhausting. It's exhausting.
That's the other thing, is it's so exhausting and it's so overwhelming that at some point you want to turn it off, which then I start going like, am I now being like a bad citizen by refusing to look at this? But I also don't think Don't they talk about that in Social Dilemma? Like, our brains are not equipped. Our brains have not taken the leaps, the quantum leaps that technology has taken.
Right.
So it's like a leaf blower in our face constantly of misinformation, disinformation, alarming truth. You know, like if you really start like getting into like why the fires are happening and the icebergs melting in the Arctic and sea levels rising 10 feet, all of which is probably true. You know, I don't know if it'll bear out that way, but it's alarming to scientists who are in the truth business, you know.
And they've become the enemy of the QAnon, of the, they've become the enemy of all the far right to the point. And the far left, the cancel culture is not helping. You know, it's just when you think that justice will be had and that there's hope, then people are looting and burning and killing. And they're not even affiliated with the peaceful protests of right. what we're entitled to and deserve as human beings. And everybody's allowed to protest. You can protest the protesters, but right. violence.
I know. You know, I will say one of the things that got me out of that spin I was in last week was I make music with Ben, but I've also...
You've been making so much good music. I've been looking at all. They got to look at your Instagram account, everybody.
Thanks. But I posted two songs that I wrote that I really liked, and I hadn't posted for a couple months, and I just got some music out there, and it's not political. It was kind of, you know, it was like one was a love song, one was kind of based on this Robert Bly thing I had read about the stages of, you know, masculine evolution.
And I love Robert Bly.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah.
And it felt so good to put some music out in the world in a modest way. You know, it's up on my YouTube page and my Instagram, and I threw one of them up on Twitter. And it just felt like, you know what? In the midst of this, I feel like writing a beautiful love song that has nothing to do with it is... it's a political act on some level, because part of encroaching authoritarianism is it's supposed to make you despairing, cynical, and hopeless, right?
Correct.
And my songs are none of those things. So part of the rebellion against the oppression of one's spirit is to put something out there that says, no, I still believe in hope. I still believe, you know, it's kind of, you know.
I believe in love. I mean.
I met your mother. It's like, it's ultimately about resilience. It's about, we love tales of indomitable spirit. You know, that's why we love underdogs. We love come from behind. We love someone that can't be crushed. So it felt to me like, I'm going to put some songs out there. And I'll tell you, it reoriented my whole mood, because I was able to offer something that was not about mine. You know, the good songs go right to the heart, right? So it says like, oh, I feel altered in this space right now with your music. And I feel like, well, that's the greatest gift I could offer into a culture that is hurting.
1,000,000,000%. And I've been trying to do comedy in my own way. The podcast is very helpful just for my connection with people and the grid. And I get to go next week to Dave Chappelle camp, summer camp. And Dave is just so gracious and wonderful. Kelly and I, my wife, are flying there. I get to do stand-up 3 or 4 nights. I'll get to let it out with a socially distanced, safe audience with COVID testing. And the people that have been going have been just adoring it. A lot of my friends have gone. Bill Burr went. John Mayer and, of course, Michael Che and Kevin Hart and Chris Rock. Chris just went and said, I want to come back.
What is it? What is the summer camp? What does he do?
It's non-televised, but I think they're filming just to have it. You're on the front steps of a house, and you do stand-up. You got a full sound system. They're going to have a guitar for me, so I get to do my comedy songs.
Yeah.
Which a couple of them are a little more activist oriented. One's called We Gotta Be Kind to Each Other, and another's called I Don't Do Negative. They do apply. But love songs are really something that takes you out of it. And it's like one of my favorite shows right now is on Apple TV. It's Ted Lasso. Have you seen this show?
Oh, is that the Sudeikis show?
Jason Sudeikis' show.
Yeah.
It is the most positive thing I've seen in such a long time. And it's just about, you know, he's going to go teach soccer and he's from America and it's in London and it's just, or Liverpool, I don't know where, but he's so, his character was based on a thing he did on NBC Sports. It's such a positive, we need that. You know, I feel like I have to be a champion of the positive, even though I get depressed, even though I'm hurting, because we share a couple of qualities. One is supreme empathy, which we are severely lacking in our leadership.
Yeah.
It's so
easy to find a way to stay in that, you know, to not get closed hearted and not join the mob of unconsciousness. You know, it's like it's there's a gravitational pull towards negativity that is very strong. It's actually, you know, four times stronger than positivity. It's like we, you know, I sometimes wonder, like, why am I trying to freak myself out right now with more dark information?
And it's easier to go down that rabbit hole. Negativity is so much easier than positivity, and people are choosing it because they, you need to be more gallant about and brave to force the positive, to be noble about it.
It is harder work. It really is.
It really is for everybody. And that's why some people are just like, well, I hate that. You know, I hate putting why do I have to put the accent on it? That's the worst part.
On Conspirituality, that podcast I've been on too, they talked with this really big woman in the yoga community named Sean Korn, who really spoke out forcefully against QAnon and took a lot of heat for it. And
You're getting heat from baby eating people or people that are baby eating, accusing people,
the accusers of the baby. Yeah. she ends by saying, she was talking about hope and holding on to hope and not getting cynical, everything we're talking about. But she talked about what is uniting everyone in this moment truly is grief.
Yeah.
And that's what needs to be talked about. And that is the point of connection. Like, you're scared and you're hurting. Oh, me too. Like, I am also, but I don't think the solution is to accuse Democrats and Hollywood elites of eating babies.
No.
Like, that's not how I'm going to deal with my grief. And I'd like to extend an invitation for you to deal with your grief in another way. It's, you know, it's that great James Baldwin quote about people won't release their anger because they're going to have to deal with their grief. Because underneath all the anger is grief. Like, what is happening? Why can't we go outside? Why did my grandmother die? I don't like masks. You know, who, like, what's going on right now?
You're taking away my civil rights by wearing a mask.
All of it. But it's underneath it is like this deep foundational grief of the knowledge that, like, we have been lied to. There is government misinformation. There is child sex trafficking. Big pharma is a mess. All of the concerns are true, but the conclusions are erroneous, you know? And I think we just have to, like, pause and maybe weep a little bit and hug from afar.
I agree completely. And people that have noble reasoning, especially people that are actors, writers, singers, activists, well-known people, that can be a hard pill for anybody to swallow sometimes, because it's like, wow, remember that Imagine video came out with all the actors and they had noble reasons for doing it 100%, but there was no way to not go, I don't know if it's gonna work for a lot of people.
Really work. So yeah,
well, Jim Norton, a comedian friend of mine, said on Twitter, he said that Imagine video got me really choked up because after I saw it I hung myself. We got to take a quick break and it's going to be quicker than you can imagine.
Has there ever been a year we're more excited for the holidays? Don't wait until the last minute, guys. Plan ahead and surprise her with something unexpected. Imagine her face when you hand her a Shane Company box tied with a burgundy bow. Does she already have a pair of stud earrings from Shane Company? Diamond, ruby, or sapphire? Trade them in for a larger size and only pay the difference from what you originally paid. Or maybe you got her engagement ring when you were young and just starting out. How about surprising her with a larger diamond? Or perhaps an exciting new diamond shape? You can upgrade her engagement ring at any time, and you'll get full credit for your original center stone. just pay the difference. Shane Company has the best upgrade policy in the business. If you're not sure where to start, make an appointment and we'll help you out. Surprise her with an upgrade this holiday and leave her speechless.
Now you have a friend in the jewelry business, Shane Company and ShaneCo.com.
All right, that was the break. This is what's so great. This podcast thing is fun. Have you had any inkling of wanting to do one at any point?
You know, I get people want me to do one. I have so many like little careers that I'm like, I don't know if I can take it on. It's not a question. I one of my favorite things in the world is just sitting down and having a unedited conversation, you know, on the record. I love it. I love being a guest on podcasts. I love having, you know, especially with people I know. But
yeah, I love talking to you right now. But I think it's your problem is you don't want to be the protagonist.
Well, there's some, I would love to curate a list of people, including people, you know, it sounds like you're doing this too. Not every fascinating person I know is famous. In fact, most of the fascinating people I know, my audience wouldn't know, but what a joy if they trust me to curate a guest list to say like, you should know this person.
Yeah.
You know, this person brings a lot of joy to my life and to a lot of people. And I'd love to just publicly share them with you. You know, that's really appealing to me. But I think I would be good at it, but I don't know. I have my teeth in so many things right now that I'm worried.
The longevity of it is the issue. Because a lot of people that are actors or people that can't work in their craft right now turn to podcasts as a way to output and possibly make some money. Maybe that's not how I look at this at all, but
Whitney Cummings tried to give me a big talking to about it. She was like, you got to do it. You got to do it. And I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. It's not for everybody. And if it's a temporary thing, it's different, but comedians have a different facility for wanting to do it. You know, because we love straight talk, you know, we love that. I had a question for you that I know there's people listening or possibly watching, but mostly listening. But the big, big thing that you were hit with, harder than I was hit with, was the ending of How I Met Your Mother. And so what was your point of view? Because I'll just tell you real quick. I went to the reading. I knew I wasn't in the episode. I knew my voiceover wasn't going to be in it. I knew that. I knew it was you doing it. I was thrilled. I've known Allison Hannigan since she's 16. So she was my babysitter. So I brought my daughter that she babysat. I brought Aubrey, who you've met, to the reading. And everybody's crying the whole time and into it. And I'm thinking, this is beautiful. And then not everyone, but some major fans were really upset by it, by the turn. What's your takeaway?
You know, I think.
I'm sorry I asked. Did I put you in an uncomfortable?
I think much like we were talking about before, it's a lot. Anger is an easier emotion than grief.
Yeah, exactly.
So people were more comfortable being angry than sad. They were sad their last show, their favorite show was ending, and they were sad it didn't end the way they wanted it to. And rather than like sit with the feelings of sadness or loss, or which is what Carter and Craig were asking people to sit with, they were asking people to sit with a story of loss and a story of redemption and a story of second chances. And, you know, not everyone was up for that. But I also feel like I hear from people every day all over the world. I mean, truly all over the world about what that show means to them and how it has inspired them and how it taught them to keep going and how it saved them from their dark nights of the soul.
Yep.
And I feel like they must have gotten something right. And I think that the ending will probably age better than it was. You know, the first draft of history is never really the draft, right?
No.
Like, I think give it some more time. It doesn't feel like it's dimmed enthusiasm for the show at all. In fact, I feel like the show is more globally kind of in the zeitgeist than it's ever been. So
yeah, it's everywhere. And everywhere. I think people just love what the show did. It was a love letter to romance, dating, friendship. going to the bar with your friends. So you had a little bit of friends in it, a little bit of cheers, but it was really like a Harry Met Sally kind of thing. I mean, that's what I was attracted to when I read the pilot.
Yeah. But
then it wasn't tied up in a bow at the very end. And I love that. Because it's real to me.
I think Billy Wilder said, it was Sidney Pollack who said, if you want to do a classic romantic comedy, don't have them get together at the end. You know, like that's what kind of gives it some sense of authenticity, you know, the sense of loss, right? I think that Carter and Craig were, you know, they were swinging for the bleachers, right? Like it was, there's a lot in that show. They put so much into it and the themes were so classic, you know, the themes were perennial. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you have similar kind of like, you wouldn't be who you were without Full House.
And that's based on the mother dying. That pilot is trying to explain to my daughter. So our show began how your show ended.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of that.
She had no mom. I had to sit and say, we're going to get through this. And then I bring in, you know, the stud and the comedian.
Maybe that's why karmically you were the right guy for the narrator in our show.
That it was interesting because I had that father feeling.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to my kids. So there's that element.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also had such a love for it. And I didn't take this. People always go, well, you just did that at home, right? And I went, no. I had 6-hour sessions for the first year or two. I would go in and I had to know what you were thinking and what you were going through.
I remember you watched the episodes and read the episodes. Like, I remember you were really deep into it.
I had to, because if I'm going to do honor to what Ted is and all this work you're doing, and I think that's why we became friends also. Because I didn't take it lightly. It wasn't a phone-in, pay-me job. I went to 20th Century Fox. I was on a soundstage. I had already seen it. And then I would really spend time going, no, that's not how he... I wanted to take however you were feeling and take that into the next beat.
You know, I do remember, and I haven't thought about this in years because it feels like so ancient, but
yeah.
That first year, you know, I didn't know how I was doing, and I had to just trust other people's opinions. And I remember you being so complimentary about my work that it made me feel, because you were watching it before I had even seen it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you were telling me how good and honest it felt, and it meant a lot to me because I was, you know, I had done, you know, 3 or 4 pilots before that and a couple guest stars, but I was a theater actor. Like I wasn't a creature of the camera, you know what I mean? Like I have so many more years now under my belt at that. So I was kind of flying blind and just trusting my instincts. And you were very kind to me. And I'm officially thanking you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you deserved it because you're great. You're really, really talented. And you have an honesty thing. And that's why they gave you a part where you would sit there and listen to all these people deliver crushing killer laughs, and then you had him.
Yeah.
But when Neil Patrick Harris walks into a room, that entrance is going to be felt.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
I mean, look at the cast. I mean, it's.
There were also, I think, when I was on the air, certain people would, you know, reach out real nicely and be like, "I fucking hate your character."
Oh, I got. By the way, Josh, that's all I ever got until years later when Full House became this celebrated family show.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone ever said anything nice to me in my life.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing because now people are like, your character inspired me more than any other character. You're my favorite actor that's ever been alive. Like, it's like out of control. But I think I had to live through, again, for History's First Draft is maybe not kind to the leading man. But ultimately you realize, oh, the show doesn't work without that guy. The show doesn't work without that center. And, you know, one thing that kept me going in those dark moments where I thought, does America hate me? All of America.
I knew America hated me. When I was on the cover of TV Guide holding a video camera, that was...
Yeah.
You know, they loved laughing, but you had the Tom Hanks role basically.
Yeah, for sure.
In the show. Yeah. And it works out. It just works out.
I think ultimately, I knew one of the things that kept me going was I knew that Ted was going to win in the end. And even though he got punched in the face literally and metaphorically every episode, there was something about it. I was like, I have to keep going because I know this guy wins in the end because he's the one telling the story. You know, history is written by the victors, you know what I mean? So I felt that gave me some kind of energy to keep moving. Because some days I loved that job and some days I didn't. I felt really vulnerable. I felt like it was costing me a lot emotionally to play him. It wasn't the trick was I made it look easy and it wasn't easy. You know, and like I said, if you do that kind of role well, it looks like you're not acting. It looks like you're being.
Yeah.
You know, but the truth is it's a skill. That leading man centering thing is a skill that is you either have it or you don't, or you can get it. But it was hard, you know, it was hard.
And the interesting part is the character was longing for love.
Yeah.
And that is something everyone can relate to. That is universal. So, and there were a couple of Jasons like that. Jason is built that way to be a forever romantic, even though he might have a very strong exterior and is a very talented man, obviously. But that was, I liked him from knowing that about him. And sure, I liked you immediately from having that looking for love. And that's how I was my whole life. I've always been a romantic and drawn toward people that are romantics.
You know, someone wrote a piece that they sent to me that really, it was like about his love of my character, but he talked about how certain people did, he honored the fact that some people didn't like the character. And he said, I have a theory about that. And the theory was that Ted was the eyes and ears of the audience. So he was the one you most related to. And we cut a lot of slack for our friends, but we're very hard on ourselves.
Right.
So I thought that was such a good insight into the person that reminds you of yourself the most. That's why we're tough on our family, right?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell
you know, it's like they're too close to our nerve endings. So that little stuff like that along the way really helped me understand, you know, what I was doing. And you know, I'm so grateful to have been a part of a show that meant so much to people and also that allowed me to be a person who could take jobs I wanted and pass on ones I didn't and be a musician and, you know, just live a life that felt really creative, you know?
Right. I share that experience. I get asked this a lot. I didn't want to ask you this. I would ask you this if we were in a restaurant right now. The question is, you ready? You ready for this question? This is a question I get asked the most, and I've already answered it 10 billion times. Do you keep in contact with the other people? That's the question. Is that not, is that not the most asked question you get?
So that's the most asked question after the show is on. The one during the show is like, who's the practical joker? That annoying, I think it was because like Woody Harrelson and Ted Danson used to play pranks or Clooney's a prankster.
Yeah.
So now there's a prank. We actually had a policy on set because Punk'd was on the air.
Yeah.
And a couple of us were asked to punk each other. And we very early on, we were transparent and we agreed we will never punk each other.
I hate punking. I hate it.
I don't find it.
It's not, but it's different if it's, I don't know. They did a good job on it. And, you know, my friend BJ Novak was on it before he was discovered into this wonderful world that he's gone on and been in. But, you know, and Jackass was a different kind of thing, which is also.
Well, they were the butt of the joke more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like those surprises. I don't like practical jokes. I don't like April Fool's.
So I'm so gullible and sincere that I'm such an easy mark.
This is why we're friends.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think I'd be an easy mark because I'm a comedian and sometimes I'll be the guy that's slinging this stuff. I am the most gullible guy in the world.
I see. I would suspect that about you, actually. I mean, But to me, I don't like things that take advantage of people's sincerity, yeah. You know, where like if someone tells me something, I my initial thought is to believe them, which is why deceitful people alarm me, because I'm when people are fluent with lying, I'm like, whoa, like it's so not a part of my makeup.
This is a great year for you.
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, part of my upset over everything that's going on is this very small child in me that is like a 5-year-old that's like, wait, I thought lying was bad. I thought racism was horrible. I just thought we had these agreed upon things that we were not, you know, that we were, and now I'm old enough to know like racism lives in me. Mendacity lives in me. It's my work. But I also am like, why aren't you doing your work? Like, why do you think it's okay to say that? And it drives me crazy.
Or think that. I don't. Yeah. I just see everyone as a human being dealt different cards. And yeah. Some of them are incredibly unfortunate. But when I was 9, when you were 9, that's when that's around the age, I think, where the veil gets pulled away or the curtain gets, you see the wizard behind the curtain and you go, wait a minute, everybody hates each other? What is this?
Yeah.
They think this of this group of people. I never understood it now, but I'll tell you what's coming out for me through this conversation is that I now know why I played you 20 years later in a voiceover.
Yeah.
I mean, we have very, very similar attributes.
Yeah. It's a part of me that is both a lovely part of me and a naive part of me. And I don't even mean that disparagingly. But the naivete is something I don't fully want to renounce. You know what I mean? To totally. Retain your ability to be shocked is a good thing. Because when you're unshockable, you're a cynic. You expect the world to be dishing up nastiness. And I don't want to live in that world. You know?
That's unfortunately what's happening. And people say to you 4 times a day, did you hear what he just said? And why are you surprised? And I'm constantly surprised because I can't believe that it's being said, being thought, and people are believing it, and it's not based on anything, and then it's retracted 2 hours later. That's just a world I don't want to live in, but I want to live in it, and I want to make it better. I want to do whatever I can to make it better.
And then you look at, like, well, what are my gifts? What is my audience? What is my, you know, like, for instance, I'm not a government reformer. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not a politician.
Correct.
You
know, same.
What do I do? I write things. You get my newsletter, yeah?
Yeah.
You get that? Yeah. So I write a monthly thing where I try to really communicate what's going on. I recommend things that inspire me. I write music. I try to be conscious about the jobs I take and the projects I throw my energy behind. But I'm not... you know, I'm a storyteller ultimately, and I believe in the holiness and in the sanctity of story. I really do. But I have to just tend to my own garden on some level. You know what I mean?
Like, you have to take care of yourself. You really do.
And also, like, this is the, you know, if I have a plot of land where my own kind of stand-up camp where I can invite people, you know, figuratively, like, come over here. This is the campfire that we're telling stories around, you know? And these are the kinds of stories I want to tell. If this is your vibe, join us, you know? And I'll try to amplify other people that I feel like are aligned with what's going on with me. But there's some dark campfires out there.
It's insanity. It's insanity. It's almost like a South Park episode became alive. Because 15 years ago, we'd watch South Park. It was already accurate where you'd go, here is the head of the Senate. And it's a split screen. And then they would say, which is not an appropriate word, they would say, and here is a midget in a bikini. And those are the two people that were going to have a discourse. One has maybe 200 people that know they exist and follow them somehow. The other is, you know, a part of the political system that, you know, a billion people would look at. And that's where we're at. Any fringe person can have some belief and be given airtime.
Well, it's also, I feel like the people with these wacky kind of fringe beliefs, their worldview is so oversimplified. and their talking points are so bludgeoning and so black and white. They see the world in so black and white. There's no nuance. There's no subtlety. There's no introspection. And the algorithm, you know, that rewards, that's following us, it rewards that kind of incessant, you know, it's like a politician has three talking points and that's all they're going to talk about. And the world to me is so much more complicated and so much more gray. And it's why.
And ever changing.
And ever changing. Exactly. I'm on Twitter, but I've never felt like I excelled in that medium because I don't. I'm a little bit like Talmudic, you know. I'm like, on the one hand, there's this, but on the other hand, you know,
right.
There's something fundamentally Jewish about my way of thinking, which is like, let's look at both sides of.
And let's bring everybody to the table. I was saying that before I brought you on, because that's what's missing is the ability, like there used to be, I guess, when they founded the damn country, to be able to. And let's not get into that because. You know, they were.
I don't know if that's true. What you're about to say,
but, way yeah. flawed. But they still formed it. They formed a place where you're supposed to have freedom, and there were people arguing.
Yeah, they were also beating each other with their canes on the Senate floor. You know what I mean?
That's a lot less painful than what we're going through right now. I'm scared of the presidential debates. I don't want to see it. It's turning into Thunderdome. I don't want to see, you know, the president punch Biden. You know,
I almost don't know that I'll watch them, although he looks pretty great right now, Biden, in terms
he's been incredibly strong and is, you know, people are going, why is he's in his bunker? No, he's not. Did you not see where he was today? You know,
but there's something I sometimes can't watch like Olympic diving or figure skating because I'm so afraid of them hitting their head. Or
Cirque du Soleil must be fun for you.
Oh, I can't do it. I'm like this. I feel the debates would be like I want to read the analysis afterwards. I don't know that my nervous system can take real time exposure.
I think what I will do maybe is watch it afterward because it will be obviously available everywhere.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then have that scanning ability is to protect your mind and your soul.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got to say, I'm not just anti-Trump at this point. I'm actively excited about a Biden-Harris administration. Like if come, you know, whenever the votes are counted, if that's who is in office, I'll just feel, and I know that's not going to solve everything. And I do not think they're messianic figures on any level.
I think they're same here. Yeah.
But I just feel the Democratic experiment is so fragile right now and in such peril that I just feel like a steadying of the ship, you know, we need the fever to turn down a little bit.
I just want what I've always wanted. And I think I could have even written the perfect things for the president to say that could make him win tomorrow, which is to own stuff, to say that I've done this, to say that I exaggerate, I talk at the mouth, I haven't cared. I know it's impossible, right? But if he did it, if he even faked the empathy on a teleprompter and then didn't rattle off the opposite all night long on Twitter, but he could win hands down and get undecideds if he stayed consistent for a week.
I think part of his appeal is his strongman alpha male, you know, retrograde masculinity.
Yeah, this renegade maverick.
His ability to ever admit fault. You know, the very things that we loved about Obama, you know, his humanity, his doubting of himself, his appropriate doubting of himself, his weighing of all available facts and information. That's not what this guy is. This guy is being rewarded for his, you know, this kind of John Wayne laughably alpha kind of thing.
And it's the narcissism. It's not getting outside of your head.
He doesn't know there's a place outside of there.
And he was raised that way. So we can all go, oh, but you know, his past and this is why this happened. He doesn't care. He doesn't want to hear that.
You know, Fred Trump is a perfect example of why parents matter. You know, it affects the whole world.
I'm going to take one more quick break. It's going to be so quick. All right, break's over, but it was a good break.
It was awesome.
Yeah, I know. I think so many phrases came out of this past 2 years. Well, that's a lot to unpack. I always hear that.
Yeah.
Or I think the takeaway here is, and I find myself saying it, and you
unpack, watch. I think came from university speak. I remember, you know, like, we can unpack that. It was a very
right
immediate thing. But go on. What were the other ones?
Well, there's so many of them. I'll probably have to list them, but then I'd be doing a great George Carlin bit, because he already, yeah, watching things he said, you know, 20 years ago is prophetic now. He's right there. Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Well, in show business, they go, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. Dude, I like the term kick the tires.
That's a good one. But that feels like the 50s.
Yeah.
I like that. That's a nostalgic one.
Right.
I'm also, when I take in my news, I do watch all of them. I watch, you know, I sometimes go to Fox first. And sometimes I go, wow, that was kind of cool that was said. And then that person is almost fired or reprimanded or not, because they have to give some honest documentation of what we're living. And then, yeah, I'll watch the other ones and I'll go, well, CNN, I like those couple of broadcasts, but that one seems, it's not what I want. I really need news people. I need a president to look into the lens, and I need a broadcaster to look into the lens. And it's all money right now. Everything is money. Everything is just selling time. And it's like a giant explosion happened today. We'll tell you about it right after this. And I hear it on every single network. And that's where we're at. We're there.
Yeah, I think it's probably a misreading of history to think that this dysfunction started in February of this year. You know, this is a cascade of events that has stacked on top of each other, you know, that the monetization of everything. I think part of the grief we feel nationally is this sense that we are just tiny consumers. We are just looked upon as, you know, people who eat and buy, and you know, when you lose that just a soul, you know, that we're soul sick, right? We're hurting because we don't have this, you know, the full dimensionality of our humanity is not being recognized, not being seen, not being tended to, not being elevated. And I think, you know, that you could say that to someone on the right or the left, and they would probably be like, yeah, I feel that, if they know how to, if that language is something that's resonant with them.
I have friends on the right that are feeling exactly that. And I'm not losing their friendship over this, because they're not losing mine.
Right.
And so, but you know, we tend to go toward people that are like-minded.
Yeah. And then you're in this silo of, you know, everything gets amplified. I mean, one of the things about Twitter that alarms me is, like, I think it creates a kind of, it's a radicalizing element. It creates zealots, you know, and I love the zealots I agree with, you know.
I know, isn't that, we're all the same.
Really nailed that one.
Right. You
know? And then I see these other people, the zealots on the other side, where I go, and I don't even like saying the other side, because I,
there isn't one, but it's all been created. These two sides have been created by both sides.
Yeah, and when Trump says, you know, blue state deaths don't count, you know, Birbiglia had a great tweet about that. Like, if you think blue states' deaths don't count, you cannot call yourself patriotic. That is the most unpatriotic thing. And
he's been saying some incredibly prolific stuff. It's lovely.
Yeah, Mike is amazing. I think he's really just a special guy. And you know, some people are being even more vocal than me. Here's the thing, though. I worry, like, I have a friend who posts a lot on Instagram, and I love this guy. Like, I love this guy. He's one of my favorite people in the world. I literally agree with everything he posts. And sometimes I'm like, ugh, enough. It's just relentless. So I couldn't be a more sympathetic audience. And I'm like, this again, right?
I cannot heart that one. I'm tired. I need a break from loving everything.
But it shows that there's something about that space when people say, be relentless, do this. And I'm like, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if social media, you know, where it's all so siloed. I don't know. Look, if Twitter could win presidential elections, Hillary would have been the president. I mean, you didn't get the feel. When I was on there in 2016, I didn't think anyone was voting for Trump.
Same.
You know,
I was out to dinner and with a friend and watching TVs in this restaurant and my mouth dropped. And we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, if people can find mailboxes, I'm afraid, you know, if I have an absentee ballot, which I do, I'm going to go to the polling place.
I did read something that really comforted me in the Washington Post where it was said that 96 to 97% of all ballots cast are going to have a paper trail. And it was only 80% in 2016. So in the last analysis, there will be, at the end of the day, there will be verification possible for a large number of these. So that made me feel a lot better. But this, you know, the post office, like, nonsense. Yeah,
how did that happen all of a sudden? It was so obvious. And everything that is called what the Democrats are doing and blaming Biden for the state of the world when he's not running the country.
Unbelievable.
I don't know how. And then the base goes, that's right. He's the bad guy. But all he's doing is trying to be the father or the grandfather of the country. And that's what I want to be. I don't think the world's going to change overnight. But there have been a lot of documents that were signed with that weird, unusual heart monitor's signature that the president signs with, that giant pen that he, you know, he forced rule on people with executive orders. And I don't see if Biden were to win that he would just come in and reverse a lot of it. But how do you not stay part of the environmental constitution of the world? How do you pull out of that because it costs you money? How do you drain the earth of oil and not even understand that it's like draining the blood out of your body? It's just, it's so simple.
Yeah. I'm trying to, if I loathe being made into an enemy, you know, if someone says like, oh, you're a Hollywood elite pedophile, money grubbing Jew, whatever they're going to call
it. You forgot pizza.
Yeah, the pizza. I mean, if I'm being
most of us, if we're good at camera ready, we don't eat pizza for at least a week.
But if I'm going to be called that, I don't like that, obviously. So I don't want to engage in the same dehumanization of the other people.
Right.
I heard Stephen Hassan interviewed, who is like the world's most like foremost leading cult deprogrammer. And he was in the Moonies for 2 years, right? And he just came out with a book called The Cult of Trump, because you're seeing, anyone who researches cults, like you're seeing that this is a cult. You know, it has cult dynamics at play. QAnon, right, certainly. But the whole gestalt around Trump is very cult-like. You know, the authoritarian, domineering leader, don't believe your ears and eyes, listen only to me, get your information all from me. It's very cult-like. But he said this beautiful thing at the end of the interview that really moved me, which was, you know, you have to stay in contact with the people who are in a cult. You cannot say, are you insane? And don't ever call me again, because it deepens their sense of isolation and everything that's thrown them into the arms of this, you know, dishonest kind of narrative, it deepens it. So what he says is stay in touch with them, ask how they're doing. Say you'll read something that they want you to read if they'll read something you want them to read. And he said, the reason I know that this is the way it is because when I woke up from my, you know, Moonies slumber, my parents didn't yell at me. They didn't shame me. They hugged me and they said, welcome home. You know, he said, my neighbor made me chocolate chip cookies. And that was the beginning of my bridge back to my life and to being plugged into the larger, you know, human family. So, you know, there's going to come a moment, and I don't know when, but like at some point, a lot of these people are going to realize like, oh, we haven't been following the light worker, of Trump, you know, and there might be some real pain and grief attached to that. The worst thing we can do is say, I told you were an idiot. You know, the best thing we can
or
do is
I hate them or I hate him. And that hating someone who is used to being hated and has all the artillery to fight back, that just antagonizes them. And it doesn't get, not that you're going to show someone the light, but a lot of people that are in support that might be angry at what we're talking about right now, a lot of them are really good people. I hate to say that, but because it sounds like there's both good people on both sides with tiki torches. But, you know, which of course was done out of context. And then I look at the things like, oh, wait a minute. And then, but, you know, we don't even fucking know half the shit the sound bites. There's one, here's a block of Portland on a tape. And that will run for a year. And that's the, look what happened. Look what they've done. And then it's the same. I go, wait a minute. Show me a different angle. Give me a different clip.
It's just, or you ran that clip last week.
Or a commercial that the Republican Party ran with Russian jets in it, not American jets.
Yeah.
So that's a faux pas. That's someone just so upset they're going to screw up and be beheaded that they don't look at the kind of plane they're putting in the footage.
Yeah. But, you know, facts are never really the the thing that sways people. You know, I was in Nashville most of December, and I talked to a lot of like really cool people, a lot of musicians who grew up in like evangelical families, you know, and who were kind of ex-evangelical themselves, but they were still, you know, close with their family. And a couple of them told me like, oh yeah, both my parents voted for Trump. And they said, I swear to you, my parents are not racist, right? It's not like, well, they're just like, that was just kind of, I don't know if everyone in their church was voting for them, or the amount of the levels of compartmentalization we're able to do to make a decision like that. I mean, and you know, I've seen this said many times, but it's like, you might not think you're a racism or that you're a racist if you vote for him, but you're certainly plugging your ears around a lot of racism. You're certainly saying it doesn't bother you enough to not vote for it. It's not a deal breaker, because the guy runs an unambiguously racist campaign. He's been doing it since he came down the escalator.
Coming down the escalator. I hope I never hear those words again. Just why can't you take the...
It might be like a very foul sex move that we...
It's like the rusty trombone. It could have been an elevator. In this case, it's going to be a bad joke, going to make people pissed off. Patton Oswalt would be happy. He should have arrived in a dumbwaiter.
I like that.
Are you able to do any work now? Are you getting ready to be able to do something?
I wrote a feature, or co-wrote a feature rather, that I'm hoping to put together. I don't want to say anything about it just because I'm superstitious, but I won't. We have another season of Hunters coming up that won't be until spring of next year. But that was announced recently.
Well, congrats. I'm excited about that.
Yeah. And I'm going to put out some music, like some solo music. I'll send you the EP that I'm going to put out, these five songs. And, right now I'm trying to lend my voice to where I feel it's useful, and, just keep my wits about me.
You're such a good man, Josh. I'm so happy we're friends.
Me too, Bob. It was really good to connect with you.
You too. So I'm going to hit you up, and we're going to do a socially distant, which means we'll end up 6 feet apart. But I'm looking forward to it because it's just a drive. We can do this.
We can do it. We can do it. That mighty 405.
Well, I'm sending you so much love. And
you too. Right back at you. Yeah.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, man. I'll talk to you. Josh Radner, what a sweetheart, right? Honored to be the voice of him 20 years from now. Maybe I'll do that again. We'll do something where I'll be the voice 20 years. We'll do some sketch. I don't know, some video for, I don't know. Who do you do it for? All Things Comedy, Funny or Die, College Humor, ourselves. Maybe we just do it for ourselves. Nobody sees it. He is a really special guy. And I know you feel that way because that's why you were listening to this. Anyway, Josh Radner, keep an eye out for everything he does. He is a loving, caring soul. And also is honest and is sympathetic for people no matter where they're coming from. And it's amazing how aligned we are on our belief system. Anyway, I adore the guy. So thank you guys for being with me on another episode of the show. And do what you do. You know, you rate, you review, you subscribe, you could follow if that's where you get your podcasts. And call that number up at the top there whenever I announce on Twitter, Instagram, stories, or Facebook that I'll be calling you guys, because I love when I get to talk to you. It's as meaningful for me as it is for, hopefully, for the people that I talk to. It means a lot because I want to stay connected to people, which is something we all kind of need, even though some of us might like being alone and or agoraphobic or whatever. This quarantine serves that. But it's nice to get out. If you can safely get out, that's a good thing. I'm sending you all my best to you and your family. Stay strong and peace and love, right? Peace and love. A piece of love. I got a piece of love for you right here. Oh, that's so romantic, Bob. Thank you, Josh Radner. Thank all of you. And I'll catch you soon.
Unexpected trouble? CashNet USA can take the stress out of borrowing emergency funds. Our fast, secure application process makes it easy to apply online 24/7. Plus, CashNet USA offers same-day funding if approved before 10:30 a.m. Central Time Monday through Friday. Additional terms may apply. Visit CashNetUSA.com or tap the banner to apply today.